From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, Wisconsin's new tourism secretary describes the fundamental battle in marketing the state to people around the country.
The brand of Wisconsin for many years is based on the idea of fun. Fun is a travel motivator for basically everyone. The challenge with fun, however, is that everyone has a different idea of what fun means.
We'll meet the Milwaukee illustrator behind a music video that addresses the epidemic of sexual violence.
I think the more voices speaking out on the topic, the better. I don't think it's just strictly a woman's issue to talk about. I think men should be talking about it as well. It's kind of a two-way street.
Plus, Eau Claire novelist Nick Butler doesn't need anyone to sell him on Wisconsin. His latest book deals with the nature of faith and also the nature of small-town Wisconsin.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. With the new administration in Madison, a new set of cabinet secretaries has taken office. They're setting the groundwork for their priorities over the next biennial budget cycle. Most of those leaders will shape policy within the state, but one is focused on how Wisconsin is perceived in the rest of the country and the world.
Sarah Meany was appointed as the state's tourism secretary by Governor Evers. The Milwaukee native worked in branding and marketing for several firms and was appointed to lead Milwaukee Film last year before being tapped to head the Department of Tourism. She joined us in the studio to talk about how she plans to go about the business of marketing Wisconsin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I am so honored to be here, Mitch. Thanks.
So with a new administration in Madison, we usually hear about changes in direction, you know, shifts in areas like environmental policy or priorities for the Justice Department or whatever. Mm-hmm. But what about tourism? What is your assessment for how the state has marketed itself up until now? And where are you in terms of setting your own direction?
That's a great question. Well, the good news for everyone is that Wisconsin is a really, really great tourism product. I am a person who loves and relies very heavily on research and data. And what the data tells us is that people who experience Wisconsin, people who love Wisconsin, love it because we have such high quality destination attractions. And as a result, that means we have really great opportunity to promote the state. So where we sit today is that there's kind of been a steady climb of growth for the state of Wisconsin in terms of visitors and revenue. The tourism economy in Wisconsin is the third largest industry, and that's a really big deal. We see $20.6 billion in revenue come in directly because of tourism and tourism-related activities, and we see a really great return on investment as well. So the good news is that the growth is there. I think we have an opportunity to accelerate that growth as compared to our competitors, particularly in the Midwest. And we're right about the middle in terms of growth compared to the average state across the country when it comes to tourism growth numbers. So I think we have room to grow in growth, but I also think that, you know, the work has been done and the foundation is strong, and there's a lot of opportunities to seek that growth.
Are there areas that are stronger than others that you're seeing?
So, you know, one of the shining stars in the tourism story for Wisconsin is, of course, the Wisconsin Dells. It's the workhorse. People know about it. They do an excellent job in the Wisconsin Dells area promoting Wisconsin Dells and putting Wisconsin on the map for a lot of people all over the country. So that's a strong area. But really, each region has its own strength. Milwaukee and Madison, as the two largest urban centers, drive a large percentage of visits and dollars spent. But then you also have to look at the Northwoods, Vilas County, kind of the northwest corner as well. You know, snowmobiling drives that economy during the winter. So what we have is a really diverse and exciting offering for people, regardless of what they're looking for. One thing that I thought was kind of interesting, and it may not be surprising to you, but I was surprised to learn that the number one reason people report that they come to Wisconsin is outdoor recreation. People spend a ton of time outside. They spend a lot of time at our state parks, in the water, on the water, hunting, fishing, hiking, backpacking. And I think that is an incredible asset that we need to make sure we take care of. And my friend Preston Cole, the Secretary of DNR, And I have a lot of ideas on how to work together to make sure that more people know about those great outdoor resources and make a bigger deal out of it in the future.
How much of the dynamic for you is selling Wisconsin to people around the Midwest, around the country, other parts of the world, and how much of it is selling Wisconsin to itself, you know, people from Milwaukee going to the Dells or Door County or what have you?
That's a great question. You know, it's kind of the question of the century. A lot of states, based on what I've seen and what I've gathered from my peers around the country in the, you know, in similar positions, is that it really has to be a delicate balance. It's a mix. When we're talking about the goal of growth, however, over-focusing on a Wisconsin-based audience kind of just means we're moving money around the state. The money that you may have spent in Milwaukee or that you may have spent in Rhineland, or you're going to go and spend it in Door County instead. When we're looking at the bigger picture of growth for tax revenue and for revenue and jobs in the state, there are opportunities for growth outside of the state that I think we need to look a little further into. So there's a balance between them. And I think it really kind of depends on how the economy is doing in general. People go further afield when things are going well. People stay closer to home and drive when things are a little tougher. So it really is a question of how do you stay steady over time and where do you look to grow?
What was it about this job that made you eager to take it on?
Oh, my gosh, Mitch, this is like a dream job. When it first became a possibility that it could become my next move, I reached out to a lot of people who know more about what this would be than I did at the time. I've never had a role in state government. I am a marketer, a strategic marketer by trade. So, you know, looking at it from the outside in, it looked like fun. It looked like a fantastic challenge. But what I didn't really know completely until I jumped in head first is how things really would work and what it would mean. So for the most part, having worked in tourism industry marketing engagements in my past life and throughout my career, I know enough to know what this was going to be about. But in terms of the work that I would be doing, you know, it's kind of a new adventure every day.
So what are the challenges in developing a brand for a whole state, especially one that has, you know, both Milwaukee and Rhinelander and Eau Claire and Superior in
right,
it?
Right. That's the thing about it, Mitch. It's it is a challenge. Branding in and of itself is an art and a science. What we have to do is find a common ground that lifts the entire state together and that we can all buy into. Many states that are doing it very, very well do it in a very holistic and very stakeholder involvement way. I anticipate doing it the same way. The brand of Wisconsin for many years is based on the idea of fun. Fun is a travel motivator for basically everyone. The challenge with fun, however, is that everyone has a different idea of what fun means. For some people, fun is being left alone on a quiet walk in the woods. For other people, fun is having as many people around you at a loud concert that you can possibly have. And that makes it very challenging. So I think what we're interested in looking at is what does that mean to people? How has that been resonating? And digging into the research and find out what, if any, evolution our brand might need or might actually have evolved into on its own. So I think the challenge is real, and that was why it was exciting to kind of take it on. There are a lot of opportunities to look into that, and I'm looking forward to where we're going to go.
You said that the states that do it well do it in a really kind of holistic way. What are some of the states that you look up to in terms of how they have been able to market themselves?
That's a tough question, but it's also kind of an easy question. So we have a neighbor to the east who has been doing this very well for a very long time. The strategy behind it, and there's a reason why I'm not naming it, Mitch, but the strategy behind it is something that we in the Midwest are pretty familiar with. It's been consistent. It's been emotional. It's been memorable. And those are kind of the hallmarks of really, really strong brand identity, but also especially in the travel space where purchasing decisions and action decisions are very emotionally driven. We back it up with logic when we have to spend money on something, but we know how we want to feel and we're seeking an experience. Another example would be New Mexico. New Mexico has had a really strong growth and a really, really great identity built around New Mexico True. I think it's true to the experience, and that's really another hallmark of a well crafted brand position and a well-crafted marketing strategy, it needs to actually be what people experience. If it's a disjointed story from what people actually feel, see, and experience when they're in our state, then we might be doing it wrong.
How much of it is about a slogan?
Slogans. So slogans are a fun little argument.
I mean, I still remember, you know, like Virginia is for lovers. Right? And I, you know, and I think about that in 2019 and I wonder what in the world does that mean?
Right, right. Well, if you were to look at all 50 states and how their tourism entities, which are all very differently structured, of course, handle it, some have slogans and others simply have a position. And that position may be one word and it may be a feeling and it may, you know, evoke a specific thing that is different for each consumer. There's many schools of thought on slogans. Slogans age and get old, positions do not. They can evolve and grow. So for the most part, a slogan is what you'll see related to a specific campaign within an ongoing, activity. You may see a slogan related to a seasonal outreach campaign. But for the most part, a brand doesn't necessarily need a slogan if it is true to the experience that it's representing.
And realizing you have not been on the job all that long, what are the challenges you see out there? What are the things that Wisconsin has to overcome to reach people the way you want to?
It's as though you knew where I wanted to go next, Mitch. Wisconsin has had a flat budget for tourism for quite a long time. And frankly, that's neither here nor there. When you have limited dollars, you have to make choices very strategically. We are not as well funded as some of our neighboring states. We are below average in terms of state tourism funding compared to the United States. On average, states have about $19.8 million to spend on a state tourism campaign. We have 15 and a half for the last several years.
You have a staff of a couple dozen.
Right, exactly. And most of that money, most of that spend goes toward promotion and advertising. And of course, advertising gets more expensive year over year. And when the money stays the same, it's harder to keep up. And the name of the game in marketing and in brand is really about awareness. And awareness means eyeballs, and eyeballs cost money. So part of it is being strategic. Now, not all promotional activity is in paid advertising. We all know there's a mix that you have to have there. There's earned media, things like PR and social media. There's owned media, which is how great is your content on your website, how great are your brochures and your materials. And then, of course, there's paid media. So the really, really expensive stuff is requires time and skill and consistency. And so that's one of the hardest challenges I think we're going to need to overcome. I think there's opportunities to do more in-house in making content, making video, telling stories. But I also think there's a lot of opportunities to partner with public and private entities who have stories to tell as well, where we can use the megaphone and amplify that across the state and across the country and the world because we are Travel Wisconsin. So those are kind of coming at it from two different angles.
How much does the success or the existence of things that you can't really control as a tourism department, things like the success of the Milwaukee Bucks, the Brewers, the Packers, or events like the potential for the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee, how much does that mean to tourism here?
Oh, my gosh. It is. Those are opportunities that you cannot replicate. We look to 2020 as an incredible opportunity to build off the 2018 Brewers and Bucks season, which is unprecedented, I think, for many of us to have, you know, two out of three of our big, big teams doing so incredibly well. We have an opportunity to put our state on the map in the most positive way that we can. And we take that really seriously, knowing that we have an opportunity to kind of change the narrative around how the national and international media tends to portray Wisconsin. You can't control that, to your point. But what you can do is get out ahead of it and help people change their perception if it's incorrect and let them see and know what we already know is a really fantastic place to visit, a fantastic place to live, and a fantastic place to invest businesses in. So I really look forward to the opportunity to make Wisconsin shine.
So let me ask maybe it's a silly question, but you know, you look at let's take the Milwaukee Bucks, for example. There's a guy that plays for them. He might be an international superstar, and he is from Greece. As the Wisconsin Tourism Department, do you look at selling the story of Wisconsin to tourists from Greece?
Absolutely. Well, and the Bucks are doing a great job of doing that already. Greece has found reasons to tell that story and come here as well. Without question, being able to leverage the assets that we have, I wouldn't want to compare Giannis to our beautiful outdoor recreation facilities. I mean, it's apples and oranges. But what we have is an incredible set of assets, and some of them are time-bound. And using that opportunity to really get the story out and leverage it is super important. That doesn't mean necessarily, though, that you want to put them in an advertising campaign. And maybe you do, maybe you don't. That we have yet to determine. But really, you know, I anticipate the state working very closely with the team at the Bucks. You know, they've pledged incredible support for state tourism. You know, the leadership there want to see Wisconsin as a whole, not just the team and not just the Milwaukee region, succeed. That means success for the Bucks as well. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship. The same is true for the Brewers. The same is true for the health of our airports, right? So what we need to do is really come together and focus on where growth really comes from and where people are listening.
So what have you gotten to do so far as tourism secretary?
I think one of the coolest things I've gotten to do so far, man, it's kind of every day there's something exciting to do. I went snowmobiling for the first time. And as a Wisconsin girl, I'm a little embarrassed I hadn't had a chance to do that before. I feel like I've spent more time on water, doing water motorsports maybe than on snow sports. But I've spent more time in silent sports on snow than in motorsports. That was an incredibly fun opportunity. I was up in Vilas County and I attended the Association of Wisconsin Snowmobile Club's annual gathering, and I learned, and I had no idea, the impact that the volunteer snowmobiling clubs had on the tourism economy in the winter in the northern region of the state. Without those volunteers, there would be no snowmobiling industry, period. But I also got a chance to drive a snowmobile trail groomer, which is a thing.
I may have seen a picture of this.
Yes, I was just as surprised by it. I saw this crazy huge truck with a huge sled that gets pulled behind it. And I said, hey, can I drive that thing? And they were really kind and let me do that. And I went about a half a mile and didn't screw anything up, I think. So that was pretty cool. I'm excited now to play a role on the board of directors of the Wisconsin State Fair. I am a regular attendee of the State Fair since I was a little girl. And to picture myself as part of that leadership team because of this opportunity is really, really cool. And I think that's just the beginning. I've met some amazing people who are very, very dedicated to the industry.
Well, Sarah Meany, I hope you'll come back and share some of those experiences with us as you go along.
You can count on that.
All right. It was great to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Meany is the designee to be the Wisconsin Tourism Secretary, pending approval by the State Senate. You can read more about her and her work at WUWM.com.
Coming up, Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep's new album includes a song addressing the epidemic of sexual violence. We'll meet the illustrator behind the powerful video that accompanies that song when Lake Effect Weekend returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
A terrible defeat, but the jury has spoken, and they believed your lie. You're just an innocent man in a drunken disguise. What you do to her, what you do to her, you
should never. Back now with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. We spoke with Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep not long ago on this show about his latest album, Primetime Illusion. The new release includes a song co-written by Bob Dylan, as well as one co-written by the late WUWM program director, Bruce Winter.
But there is another song from the album that's gotten attention for both its subject matter, sexual assault, and its 1960s-style music video. The song is called What You Do to Her, and the video is animated by Milwaukee artist Casey Hoagland.
Hoagland joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio and explains her approach to the project.
I definitely focused on the lyrics and thought about how empowering it is for women. I thought we're going to have to come up with some imagery that's pretty powerful to match that. And in my head, I went through a bunch of different color ideas, and I just started envisioning color palettes and maybe some subject matter and things that would work well with the lyrics, as he was talking, yeah.
Right. So the song is about, you know, the epidemic of sexual assault and the effects these attacks have not only on the women who endure them, but the communities surrounding them. So the verses of this song kind of tell the story of someone who gets away with sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And with your color scheme, you know, you mentioned you were thinking of what would fit. So there's kind of the faded red, the off-white, the different shades of blue.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you pick those? Was that a play on how the American system deals with sexual assault overall as a country? Or was it just something that was naturally in your head, its primary color scheme?
It was just kind of naturally came into my head, and I definitely associated the blue with that deep navy blue color with like a darker tone as to what's happening. And then, we ended up going through quite a few different color variations, but those are the ones that we landed on and felt best suited the overall theme of the video. And yeah, it just kind of formed as we went along working with it.
When you're thinking of the schemes as you're listening to the song, how long was the process of being pretty firm with, like, okay, this is the direction I want to go in? Because I imagine there's hundreds of ideas that could have gone through your head.
Trapper was really great about giving me some creative freedom. So I would just kind of sketch in my sketchbook and then show it to him, and he was all about it. And then some things towards the end, he was like, okay, we can fix this and this. He kind of just let me throw everything out there, and then towards the end kind of start nitpicking and fixing it.
Yeah, and the song, you know, Trapper's known for his folk Americana music, so the mm-hmm. song is upbeat, it's driving, has, you know, high harmonica melodies. So despite the theme of the song, you know, if you take away the lyrics and just hear that instrumental background, it is upbeat, you know, maybe kind of contradictory to what some people may think of a song about sexual assault. So mm-hmm. how did you want to approach the opening to set the tone?
Initially, we had a different intro for the video, and we felt like since the beginning, the harmonics was a little bit more uplifted. We felt, you know, maybe kind of tone it down a little bit. And he liked the eye symbol that we have throughout the video, so we kind of just threw that in there as a symbol for the women that deal with this every day, and I feel like that's a good opening to what the song is about.
So can you expand upon the eye and the relationship to the women dealing with that every day?
There's a part in the song that's, I see you in the paper, I see you in the street. So when I heard that, I just thought of an eye kind of morphing and moving around. And then we like the visual of that and how the eye can be kind of anonymous. It's not a specific woman, but it kind of symbolizes women as a whole. So we put that in there. And then, yeah, it's kind of just symbolic of seeing these people that are doing these acts and representing women.
The women also shapeshift a lot yeah. in the video, as well as, you know, various objects and mm-hmm. in its ease of transition. So how did you want to accomplish that and see laying out in your head what was the best flow to keep that circular motion going?
I feel like the morphing is kind of symbolic of how the culture is shifting around it. Things are kind of flowing and moving more so surrounding the topic. And the morphing of the women's faces, I felt like initially it was about how anybody we know can be a victim of this. So different anonymous women morphing into each other, I felt like it could kind of send that message of anybody could be a victim of this, and the culture around it is shifting and we're kind of waking up to it.
And I suppose it's a testament that Trapper wrote the song that the culture is shifting, that men are becoming more vocal mm-hmm. about this issue. What did that mean to you for him to approach you and say, like, this is my song that I wrote about this issue?
I think the more voices speaking out on the topic, the better. I don't think it's just strictly a woman's issue to talk about. I think men should be talking about it as well. It's kind of a two-way street. We need to work together and kind of fight this thing that's happening throughout the country and the world. And yeah
on that note, there was one moment in your video where, you know, a man is holding a flower, and at first it's being thrown to the ground, but then mm-hmm. more grow from the ground and turn into prison cell bars, which I thought was a really powerful image.
Thank you. Yeah, we kind of use the flowers symbolically as women, but obviously they're not taking it anymore with the Me Too movement. So just symbolizing that with the prison bars, and it's going to stop. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, despite the song, the story of it, you know, with the man getting away, how did you and Trapper want to really examine the meaning of this song and the momentum that you need to carry forward from it? Because even though the song doesn't necessarily have a happy ending, you know, it doesn't come full circle, what do you want to give as a message to listeners and, of course, to viewers who are looking at this music video?
Pretty much that this song and the imagery that I put in it is kind of meant to empower women in these scenarios where these guys are getting away in court and they are basically just getting slap on the wrist for what they're doing. It's kind of hopefully meant to, like, we have the power to stop this, you know, and we can talk about it, and Trapper's talking about it, and I hope my imagery is kind of representing that, just basically empowering women to end this.
When it comes to your drawing style, it kind of is reminiscent of, say, Woodstock poster art 60s, you know, very clean lines, you know, distinct shapes and features, but all having a good flow despite that separation. So what, in the first place, you know, drew you, well, that's a, I guess, a way to say it, what brought you to drawing and illustration?
Just when I was younger, I always did it. I would sit with my friend in class and we would just share a sketchbook back and forth and share, and I just always enjoyed it, and eventually I became known as the art kid, I guess. And I was fine with that. I was happy with making art for people and for myself, and I just kind of knew that that's what I was going to do, so that's what I'm doing.
That's good. Well, and you're in your last year at MIAD here in Milwaukee. Already you've built up a portfolio of working for other people outside of class assignments. Do you see that this transition coming up, that it perhaps will be a little easier compared to a lot of other college students, that you feel an affirmation of the direction you're heading in?
Yeah, I feel good about the things that I've accomplished in college so far. I mean, the other people in my grade, though, they are so talented, and I look at them, and I will say I do have some really good competition, and you know, I'm happy to see that. I feel like my class as a whole is really doing well, and yeah, I mean, the transition, I have some things lined up after that, and so I'm doing good.
With your style being already cemented in a way when you're so young, what do you want to experiment with once you're done with school?
I want to experiment more with animation, for sure. I'm currently doing some more animation for my thesis project at school. I've also experimented a little bit with digital sculpting and 3D sculpting for different video game assets. I've been playing around with that and some concept art and just playing around with, you know, the basics, how I use color and line. I'm more so focused on the digital aspects of turning my drawings into animation or digital 3D sculptures, and seeing how that I can morph my style into that form.
Is that interactive component important to you as well?
More so it has been, yeah. I like seeing people who are watching, like, the What You Do to Her video, how they react to, as the imagery kind of morphs. I like seeing how they experience that and getting feedback on it, and I like seeing people interact with what I've been making lately, and it's a lot more in depth than I feel just a 2D image and having someone walk by and stare at it. It's like you can see them taking time and really focusing on what's happening throughout the timeline, and it's cool.
Well, the effort certainly paid off. It's a job really well done. Casey Hoagland, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
Milwaukee artist and MIAD student Casey Hoagland is the animator for the video that accompanies Trapper Shep's song, What You Do to Her. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. The song is from Trapper's recent album, Primetime Illusion, and you can find links to the video and to his in-studio session with us at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then chat with Wisconsin novelist Nick Butler, whose new book tackles some major questions about the nature of faith and religion and also paints a positive picture of small-town Wisconsin life. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
In a drunk in disguise, what you do to her, we all see. What you do to her, you should never be free. What you do to her, we all see. What you do to her, you should never be free.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. 10 years ago, the death of a Wisconsin girl made headlines here and around the country when it was revealed that her family had foregone medical treatment for diabetes in favor of faith healing. That story and the questions it raised provide some of the backdrop for the latest novel by writer Nicholas Butler. Little Faith is set in a small fictional town in western Wisconsin, not too far from Butler's real home in Eau Claire.
It is told through the experiences of 65-year-old Lyle Hovde, who is generally content with his life and his role as a retiree, grandfather, and occasional apple harvester. The book plays out over the seasons of a year and leads Lyle and readers to ask some deep but fundamental questions about the nature of faith and religion. Nick Butler joins us in the studio to answer some fundamental questions about the new novel. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to see you again. I'm happy to be back.
It's great to see you again, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I feel pretty lucky to live the life that I live and to publish these books, and I'm pretty proud of this one. I think it does what I wanted it to do. So.
Well, let's start with that. What were you hoping it would do?
Well, I had kind of two ideas. One was to sort of, you know, I had been kind of influenced a little bit by this sort of true crime case that happened back in 2008 where a young girl died of complications of diabetes because her parents were praying for her rather than seeking medical treatment. So that was one thing that I researched prayer healing in America a whole lot. But I began thinking that that would be a really dark book if that's what the only sort of narrative thrust was. So I started thinking that a way to kind of camouflage that or toggle that would be to write a story about a grandpa and his grandson and that kind of amazingly sweet, special relationship between the very old and the very young, and trying to braid those two stories together. So,
yeah, well, and I was hoping to kind of get into who Lyle is pretty early because it's really through his experiences that we watch this story unfold. Lyle seems to be about the most decent person you could imagine, maybe the guy we all sort of hope we might be when we're 65.
Yeah, well, so Lyle is not based on my father-in-law, Jim, but he's certainly inspired by my father-in-law. And I've known Jim since I was about 12 years old. But I think after I got married, I realized that because he has juvenile diabetes, his family had always sort of looked at his lifespan as, you know, like when he was a younger man, they told him he might not live past 50. So I started to write. I wrote a short story called Apples, which is in my short story collection, and it's about a character named Lyle. And basically, I wanted to kind of preserve the memory of who this guy was and what he means to his family and to his community. And that character had always kind of hung around. And then I just decided, like, well, I can riff off my own work. That's fine. I'm not stealing from anyone. So I wanted to write this novel that was about him and kind of celebrating his spirit. And you know, I think a lot of us, after we pass away, I wonder whether anyone's going to remember us. But one way to preserve a person's memory or spirit is in a book and in fiction. So that was certainly one of the goals here, too.
Well, and I wonder, and he's obviously not here to speak for himself, but someone who deals with such a serious illness for presumably such a long time has to have a certain outlook on life. It's the kind of thing that can either make one extremely bitter for their whole life or extremely grateful and giving, and it sounds like he's the latter.
Yeah, he's, you know, you said like that Lyle is an almost unbelievably good guy. And when you meet my father-in-law, Jim, he's like that, too. He's just incredibly helpful and kind. And the longer that I live and the longer that I live near him, the more people that I meet whom he has influenced positively. You know, he just like he'll volunteer to go fix somebody's kitchen sink or their dishwasher or something like that. And he never wants anything in return. And he's not doing it for selfish reasons. He's just that kind of person. And, you know, frankly, I don't know that we read a lot of fiction where there's characters like that, but that doesn't mean that they don't exist in the real world.
I mean, did you worry about making him too decent?
No. No, because he, you know, one way that we see who he is as a full human being and in an honest way is the fact that he really struggles with his faith, that he's in some ways angry with God.
Well, right. And so Lyle in the book dealt from a long time ago with the loss of an infant.
Yeah.
How would you describe Lyle's approach to spirituality by the time he was 65?
Yeah. Well, I think I almost want to have like a glossary of terms because, you know, there's like spirituality and religiosity. There's all these sort of different belief terms. But I think Lyle believes in something beyond the plane of normal human existence. But he can't quite go into believing that there's like a God in the clouds. And he can't quite believe in the Bible. He can't quite believe in church. So I think, you know, and not to sound like New Agey or anything like that, but he sees beauty in the natural world. He sees beauty in the orchard that he works in and the seasons and in his grandson. But he really is jaded on organized religion, if that makes sense.
I wonder if, would you be willing to read maybe a little bit of the start to chapter 5, which
yep.
is kind of where we start to understand really who Lyle is and where he's coming from when it comes to faith or spirituality or religiosity or God.
Sure.
And yeah, I don't know, maybe read till it seems natural to stop reading.
Okay. Although Lyle had stopped believing, he never really stopped attending church. Indeed, he often suspected he was not alone in this, that many millions of Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Taoists, and Mormons all around the world attended their churches, temples, and mosques as much out of routine or obligation as out of any real fervor or belief. Or perhaps to model a new dress or hat, a new pair of shoes, or a sharp suit. Guilt, he supposed, must also have played a role, for certainly not every butt in a pew was doing the Lord's work 24/7. Some might secretly be cheating on their taxes, sleeping with the neighbor's wife or husband, playing the casino slot machines or roulette tables with the children's college fund, or who knew what other litany of shortcomings from the trivial to the criminal. For others, it might be boredom or loneliness. But for Lyle, so much depended on his childhood friend, Pastor Charlie, and that lovely old country church in which he had spent so many Sundays as a child, shuffled into that hard-backed pew by his now long-departed parents.
Nicholas Butler reading from A Little Faith. You mentioned the kind of true crime story that undergirds at least part of this tale.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the catalyst that got you thinking about faith, God, religion, whatever we want to call it, or is there something there? Were you thinking about it in other ways already?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I've been thinking a lot about it personally. When my wife and I moved back to Eau Claire, We returned to our childhood Lutheran church, the church we both grew up in, matriculated through, you know, communion and confirmation classes and all that good stuff. And we kind of wanted to give our children that same sort of infrastructure, spiritual infrastructure that we grew up with. The trouble is that I don't really believe in God. So here I am, you know, not every Sunday. I'm not going to claim to have perfect church attendance because I don't really care. But I'm sitting in my church just thinking, like, what am I doing here? And what am I getting out of this? And trying to believe in something, you know, I think allowing myself to be open to some supernatural being finding me. But nothing ever takes.
And there's kind of one point where I think it's – I forget who Lyle's talking with, maybe to Hoot, his old friend, or it might have been to Pastor Charlie. But he's basically saying, you know, as long as everybody's kind of good to each other and does right by each other and, you know, whether we call it religion or not, it seems to be the way you live your life.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I agree with that, though I think for me, good writing is not judgmental, right? You're trying to not be judgmental about your characters that you create. You're hopefully looking to understand more about the way that people in the real world make their decisions and live their lives, and also how your fictional characters do that. And I mean, I've met people in my life that really, really believed, and I'm not trying to mock anyone who believes at all. I'm very curious about that. And I've met people whose lives were changed for the better by believing or being reborn or something like that. So, you know, when I handed this book into my agent, he really loved it, and he's a tough critic, but he said, man, nobody's really writing this book right now. And I didn't even think about that because I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop and Marilyn Robinson was a teacher there and Jim McPherson, people who, you know, write a lot about spirituality. But I just don't think it's very sort of in vogue right now. It's a little bit taboo. It's, you know, I think a lot of people think maybe it's even old fashioned. But to me, it's one of the universal questions about us as human beings. What happens to us after we die? Is there a soul that goes somewhere else? And so I was really interested in it.
There's really, and you know, I never want to give too much away, but there's a point at which Lyle is called on to help pray for somebody, and he can't do it, and it's a really heartbreaking scene because I think on its face it's heartbreaking, but you can see how much that inability is kind of tearing him up inside.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, Lyle is 25 years older than I am, I guess, or 26 years older than I am, but we obviously share some similarities. I wouldn't be able to write him if there wasn't part of me there. And I mean, those Sundays when I'm sitting in church and everybody else is praying, my eyes have always been open, and I just have a really difficult time sort of letting go. And it is hard, you know. I mean, when you're in a community like that of people who really fervently believe, and it seems to give them some sort of grace or solace, and you don't really feel that, I don't know. It's odd.
Are your fellow parishioners aware of the book you've written?
I don't know. I don't know. I just try to, you know. I think the quick answer to that is I don't know. You know, I choose to live in my hometown because nobody treats me differently. So I just sort of move along not thinking about stuff.
You talk about not being judgmental in writing, and there's a character in this book. He's a sort of a charismatic preacher who moves into Eau Claire, I think, or La Crosse.
Right.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
And it would be really easy to caricature him, but you seem to go to great lengths to give him some, you know, deep down redeeming characteristics. Redeeming probably being the wrong choice of words here.
Yeah, well, I mean, if a book's going to have a character that could sort of be identified as a villain, I think the work of a writer is to try and figure out how that person came to be a villain. And you know, in preparation for this book, I read a lot about faith healing and prayer healing, and I also just listened to some pretty fringe pastors, like on YouTube, and also listening to my AM radio dial every day. And when I'm driving across rural Wisconsin, I'd listen to stuff. And I'm not picking on anyone. I'm not being judgmental. Part of it was trying to get inside to understand. Okay, well, you know, what makes up this opinion, this group of beliefs, and. And I'm hopeful that people, atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, Jews, Christians, read this book. So I'd be kind of foolish to be making fun of anyone or to be, you know, making clear villains.
This is a strange way to ask this question. Not so long ago, I'm gonna name drop another writer here, and that's Leif Enger, who wrote this pretty wonderful book called Virgil Wander. And I was struck by two reviews of it that I read. Mm-hmm. One was by Ron Charles in the Washington Post, mm-hmm. and the other was by you in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And reading it, I got the sense that there are some people who get characters from small towns in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and there are some people who do not, and those people are often on the coasts. Mm-hmm. So I guess in an extremely roundabout way, the people who inhabit Little Faith are not so different than the people who inhabit Virgil Wander. Yeah. You know, Lyle and Peg, but also Charlie and Hoot and Shiloh and others. Mm-hmm. Do you think these are familiar people? Are you in some strange way an ambassador to what real people are like for you know, those of us in flyover country to people on the coasts?
Yeah.
Wow, that was a long question.
Geez, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that this book could easily be set in, I don't know, upstate New York, rural Virginia, a lot of different places, Northern California, the Wyoming and Colorado that I just traveled through. There's a lot of places where I know these characters exist. What you ask is a tough question. And, you know, I really enjoyed a lot of Leif Enger's book. It was a difficult book to review because it was a comedy. And it was filled with magical realism, and I tried as hard as I could in that. I loved it. Let me just say that. It was filled with clearly a lot of the author's passions. And I think when you're writing fiction, you should be rewarded for that. But one thing I was struck by that Washington Post review is that it didn't seem like the reviewer took any time to try and understand what the writer was doing. It was like it was kind of a lazy review. And in some ways, it was a little bit mean-spirited. And that's what kind of struck me about it. That was a book full of really kind characters. And some of them were magical. They were different. They were stepping out of, like, a mist almost, you know, and flying kites in storms. It wasn't really meant to be, like, a perfect representation of northern Minnesota, I don't think. And I tried with this book to modulate light and dark. There's a lot of happy stuff here. There's a lot of stuff that I think is the upside of living in a beautiful place without a lot of people. But there's a dark side, too, and that's that these small towns are dying and that sometimes the people that live in those small towns are susceptible to, you know, like this evangelist.
That
was a long-winded answer.
That was a long-winded question, though. So, well, and really, to your point, I got the sense that the Post reviewer, you know, saw rural Minnesota and immediately conjured up Garrison Keillor in his mind.
Well,
and
I think they mentioned Garrison Keillor in the review.
And said, you know, all books about rural Minnesota, you know, have to be graded against Garrison Keillor.
Yeah, and I think that was really unfortunate. And I don't think that was very...
it's unfair, really.
It's unfair. It's like, by all accounts, the author seems like a really cool guy. Everybody I've ever talked to says he's a really cool guy. So then to sort of lump him in with somebody who's going through a real public sort of struggle.
Yeah, exactly.
Potentially criminal kind of struggle. I don't know about that, how I felt about that.
So I was reading back through an interview you gave leading up to the Chippewa Valley Book Festival last fall, and you gave a shout out to your fifth grade teacher.
Yeah.
Who you said was one of the most influential people in your life, and the interviewer did not ask the obvious follow-up question. And I don't know whether it was just because it was an email interview or something, but I'm going to do that a few months later. What was so influential about your fifth grade teacher?
Yeah, Doug Smith. Shout out to Doug Smith. And I know you've got some listeners who are also his student. So he was kind of an older gentleman when I had him as a teacher. He was probably grandfatherly age. He'd played semi-professional baseball with like Warren Spahn and Hank Aaron. And when I think about the expectations for 21st century school children like my kids versus what we experienced in his classroom, it's totally different. And his classroom was, and I'm not saying anything mean about my kids' teachers because I love them, but his teaching style was so different. He just read to us for long periods in the day, classics like, I think Ivanhoe was one, which is, you know, that's like college level reading. And one of our projects during that year, fifth grade year I was with him, was we had to write a fictional account of the westward migration across America. We had all year to work on it, to research it. And most kids, I think, ended up around 25 to 40 pages, and mine ended up being 120 pages.
In fifth grade.
Yeah, in the fifth grade. Still one of the longer things I've written, by the way. And And I think it's really amazing and sort of magical. If you give kids books and you give them stories and you give them time to write, what they'll do. And I think it's sort of hard to – it's so hard to measure, right? We live in a society where increasingly we're pushing kids to have sort of practical jobs. So I don't have a practical job at all. You know, and I think I contribute a fair amount to my community and to our state, I'd like to think, too, even. And I couldn't do that if I had a practical job. That's just not who I am, you know. And he was the one who sort of filled me with some early confidence.
Well, I think we can all be grateful to Doug Smith.
Doug Smith, yeah, no doubt.
Everybody, shout out to Doug Smith. And we're grateful to you, Nick Butler. Thank you so much for coming to see us again. Yeah. And we'll see you at Boswell Book Company.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
Yep.
Wisconsin writer Nick Butler's latest novel is called Little Faith. It comes out next week, and he and Mitch will reprise their conversation on Tuesday evening at Boswell Book Company. You'll find more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. Coming up next, it's 4 o'clock.